if you have an innovation culture, you're trying to embrace a fail and fail fast kind of approach, that it's okay to jump in to a team and do goofy stuff, right? And make mistakes, because that's actually what allows us to know where we're really headed, and to reflect and learn really quickly. And so, and that for me also led to the realization that a student, and actually faculty for this matter, almost all of the other spaces on campus at the university have consequence for failure.
Welcome to another episode of Innovation Insights, where we dive deep into the minds shaping the future of industries through innovation, creativity, and groundbreaking research. We believe that innovation happens in all aspects of life. I am your host, Dr. Yolanda Sanders. Today, we are thrilled to introduce our distinguished guest, J.R. Campbell.
His work focuses on fostering technology-driven maker communities and assembling cross-disciplinary teams to address the world's most complex and wicked problems. JR has had a remarkable academic and professional journey before joining Kent State, where he also served as director of the Fashion School. He brought his expertise to institutions like the Beijing Institute of Fashion Technology in China and the Auckland University of Technology's Textile Design Laboratory in New Zealand. His pioneering research and creative projects in digital textile imaging span over 25 years. He has been featured in more than 80 exhibitions worldwide, earning him 20 prestigious awards, including the International Artist of the Year from South Korea. At Kent State, JR launched the groundbreaking Textile Lab, a hub that merges teaching, research, and commerce to explore the intersection of fashion and digital technology. He also co-founded the university's acclaimed National Fashion Tech Hackathon, which brings students from across the country together to collaborate on innovative solutions in wearable technology and digital design. Beyond his technical and artistic contributions, JR is a thought leader in human-centered design, intentional team collaboration, and building cultures of innovation within higher education. Under his leadership, the Design Innovation Initiative has expanded its vision with a newly established advisory board, ensuring its impact continues to grow. Today, we will delve into JR's insights on innovation, the role of making in design thinking, and how intentional collaboration can ignite transformation in education and beyond.
So please join me in welcoming J.R. Campbell to the podcast. J.R., so wonderful to have you here.
Thank you.
Yes, we have known each other a long time. I think we met at ITAA in Banff. Years ago. We were both graduate school then.
Grad students, yep.
Wow. Well, it's been so fun over the years to, one, you know, call you a colleague and friend, and then two, just to watch your career and the impact on any environment that you have been. And, you know, we didn't even name all the other institutions that you have impacted over the years, but it's really, really just been a pleasure to watch and impacted by what you do. So thank you for all you do.
Thank you. I would say the same for you, obviously.
Yeah. You're very kind. And also, I think we also have some Colorado ties too, don't we?
Yep. Some good connected backgrounds in Colorado as well. So 10 years of my life where lived in Colorado, and really I always look back, you know, try to think about how to connect to that. So I have lots of great friends there too. So
And I know you have some great friends still here in Iowa, because I ran into some of them and they're like, just talk to JR. So you have made the rounds both around the United States and globally. And so how did that journey start with design for you?
For me, I think, one of the things I always like to say, and I really think it is a little bit of, for me, reflectively, it's the root of my of this trajectory. I actually really think that I grew up in a farming family, and although my dad was educated in a way that really had him depart from that lifestyle. He's a nuclear physicist, and so that was a big change from where he grew up in small town Nebraska. My brother and I both mostly grew up in California, but each summer we were spending time for most of the summers with our grandparents in Nebraska. And so we spent a lot of time on the farm and just making and learning how to solve things and tinkering and playing. And I really think that feeds into my mindset. I think had me always craving or looking for for what eventually I recognized as design, but even more specifically, probably design thinking and that kind of, sort of collaborative awareness and willingness to jump in and tackle things even when you aren't sure you know how. So that I think has been the motivation. Career-wise, I as you said, I have background in textiles. I studied at UC Davis in California, and my first degree was environmental design. So that was a program that was intentionally about a multidisciplinary approach to design in one department or one unit, that I think also set a lot of foundation for me in my thinking. And then I went on to do an MFA in textile art and costume design that then I think really sparked my deeper desire for investigating new and emerging technologies through the textile practice. Those things together, along with the fact that as a textile artist and designer, especially as a textile designer, we are often collaborative. Textile designers are rarely the folks who are creating final product without somebody else being involved in that design process. For me, I've really always craved and enjoyed that connecting with others as a way to come up with something that's bigger than what I could do on my own.
Well, you've had some great collaborations, and it would be, I think, really cool to bring some of your collaborators on with you at some point, maybe do another episode and, just let you reflect on the collaboration. Starting off with textile design, but now you really have expanded, to work in design in such a broad range and innovation, which, you make a perfect guest for this show. How did that come about for you?
I guess for me, the spark while I was in the role as the director of the fashion school was that, I would say the curricula at the time that existed when I first began the position was fairly old school, was a little bit more focused on training students for particular jobs in the industry. And as a faculty group, we really started having bigger discussions about fashion as a lens into the rest of the world and thinking about how our students we and our students needed to be able to think about how they bring the fashion mind to their to other problems, to other sectors. And I had been, prior to that, I'd been at Glasgow School of Art, directing the Research Center for Advanced Textiles. And in that context, really saw the opportunity to start to create a similar entity within the fashion school at Kent State that became the Textab. But instead of just focusing on one textile technology approach, we brought everything that we could that was a digitally driven tool in the context of textiles and fashion into one environment. If you haven't ever been to Kenta, the fashion school has been in Rockwell Hall since it began. It had a little bit of a time for the building to be renovated for use. But the school is on the corner or edge of campus in a way that the students are pretty much always in our building, the fashion students, and no one else from other disciplines was coming in the building. And one of the things that happened when we started the textile lab was that you know, we had tools like 3D printers and the digital embroidery machine and the inkjet printing on fabric that allowed and interest students from a lot of different disciplines. And it was the first time really that we started getting students from other disciplines hanging out in the building. And so that that was a seed that helped me also to reflect on what the impact was for our own students. Cause I, you know, went out with the textile lab, when you have fashion students started to work with computer science students, interesting things start to happen. Right. But I think what also became clear as I dug into that, I started to try to connect with other entities across the university that were starting to support these kind of maker environments. What we realized was that there, none of us really had a clear knowledge of what really existed across the university in terms of open access maker environments. On top of that, there was a real clear need to, not just in fashion, but across the university, think about how we could break down some of the silos, especially for our students, and use our students as a way to help to innovate and soften the boundaries between the colleges and the departments. So for me, that became a mission as well. It's just thinking about what could we do that doesn't have to move at the slow pace of curricular development to engage students and by its very nature, engage faculty and staff and community members, you know, in those interactions that can be, you know, really deep learning, but quick and fun and inherently cross-disciplinary. And how do we build that up?
Well, you mentioned that, you know, it's important for students to have those interdisciplinary and cross-disciplinary experiences. Why? I mean, I'm with you. I'm not challenging you. I'm on the soapbox with you, but why? Why do you feel it's important?
Well, on a really basic level, it's really what most employers are actually truly looking for. They're hopefully, in most cases, the employers that we're helping to prepare our students for, they're trusting us to some degree to provide disciplinary context and knowledge and skill sets that are appropriate, right? But what really sells, you know, what really makes it possible for a student to, and thus a graduate to shine in any role is their ability to connect, to communicate, to build trust. To know how to work with people who are not like them, and to do that in a way that actually leads to something meaningful. Right? Those are skills that, you know, sadly, we don't really teach those very explicitly or separately. They're kind of inferred through, you know, our whole educational process in the U.S., but they're not really very well delineated. And so, yeah, I think the deepest reason is that it's a real need. And it's also how we get better as humans at innovating. So I think that's where I would start. There's a lot more to, what that looks like, in a design innovation context, but it's really about, helping to build those skills. It's also, I guess the other thing I would just quickly say is that it's also about, reducing the fear of stepping into the unknown, helping everyone understand that it's okay to step out of your comfort zone, and that's actually when innovation happens and when cool things happen, usually. And so stepping out of your comfort zone and getting good at that, like through practice, which I think is a design mind, to practice and continue that, is really important as well. It's what helps to lead towards innovation.
So you're probably gonna just, I sent you questions, and I'm just all over the place now. The guests of mine that are friends are, thank you for putting up with me. But I was thinking, as you mentioned, here in the U.S., you have so much experience internationally with design and innovation. And what are some lessons that you've learned from those experiences that you've brought into the design innovation initiative?
Yeah. I would say the first thing that I really have tried to ingrain deeply and certainly brought back with me from a lot of the international experiences is that we have to embrace difference and diversity as a way to see and then to see together. It's also why, I mean, as you're probably familiar with, we helped to launch, while I was in the role, we launched the requirement for all of our students in the fashion school that they have to study abroad or study away for a semester at least before they graduate from their undergrad program. And the reasons for that are similar, that perspective taking of, stepping out of your normal environment and still having to bring your authentic self to those experiences and know how to progress and achieve your goals. That I think is it was important for me, but I think it's really foundationally important for students in terms of thinking about where they're going, what they're capable of, and what they can endure. I think also the difference in sort of culture, the time that I spent in China, for instance, a few different instances. Had a lot of conversations about how most of us in the Western world are really have individual approaches to society, right? We're looking for kind of glory for individuals, and we build a lot of systems around that. Our academic system is built around like trying to create superstars and recognize individuals all the time, so faculty kind of, I felt, and many faculty feel, that you kind of get trapped into a lane and you have to stay in that lane of what you are doing, right? The research wise or otherwise. Differently in Beijing, as an example, there's a much more of a team-based collaborative approach that's kind of built into the cultural expectation. There's a lot of communication that has to happen across a number of individuals for anything that's going on, which can seem a little frustrating from an American perspective, but it's also, it allows for academically and kind of infrastructurally, it allowed for really different approaches to working with industry and thinking about the continuity of or the fluidity of for their students between employment and education in ways that I thought were really interesting. So, I think the sharing of culture is a key part in what I believe I'm doing or trying to help do at Kent State and wherever I go is really think about how we get better at building the cultures of innovation and facilitating that. And I think it means, like I sort of started with, it really means embracing the difference or the diversity of of who we all are and using that as a power, as a strength together.
Oh, I love that. I love that. And the collaboration and teamwork, that has been a theme that has come up, I think, of almost every guest that we've had as we talk about, whatever their work is and, related back to innovation. One of the really fun activities that you have been involved with, it was, the hackathon. And I think you're probably doing some other team-like projects within the Design Innovation Initiative. Can you tell us about some of those? Because I would
love to. Yeah. The Fashion Tech Hackathon was another one of those foundational moments for what has become design innovation at Kent State. I could tell you kind of my story connected to that and how it is in design innovation, because the reality is that there were a lot of people involved in our discussions about what this initiative has become and who have contributed in major ways. But I ended up jumping from the role in fashion to try to be the first kind of executive director in this entity. So my lens is weathering forward, I guess, at the moment. But the Fashion Tech Hackathon was kind of an aha moment, not just for those of us in the fashion school in terms of what I was describing earlier, students from different disciplines kind of engaging with our students more directly. And as a result, more faculty action that was kind of connected to that. But it was also, I think, for a lot of my peers and colleagues in the institution, just kind of eye-opening to see what students could achieve in the span of 36 hours and what it meant for them in that context. We spent a lot of times, one of my colleagues who was really a co-lead in our original group of people who were trying to explore what has become design innovation was Julie Messing, who was the director of our LaunchNet, an entrepreneurial support agency on campus that she pioneered and made available to all the students at the university. So we were really curious about, like, you know, how many, if we're doing hackathons, in our definition of hackathon, which was a little bit emergent from the kind of reference of computer science approaches, we really wanted people to physically prototype something by the end of the weekend that they could demonstrate as a new, you know, kind of disruptive approach. So we spent a lot of time trying to get feedback from the students on that. You know, how many of them are really that interested in, you know, doing this activity and getting an award or a prize as a way to think about how they might turn it into a marketable product or a business? How many don't really care about that and what's motivating them? As we're gathering that and seeing kind of the success of it and how it's helping us to engage with industry and community partners as well, I think it helped to show us that there really was themes that, you know, that resonate, that are inherently, you know, that just require that kind of cross-disciplinary work. So we extended that model. That's a national thon, open students from many places. We got funding in some cases that allowed us to send buses to, you know, across to New York City and bring students back from that direction and pick them up along the way, or those sort of things, as a way to really turn it into something that, you know, from my point of view, was a way to showcase what we were trying to do in the textile lab in the fashion school. And just for clarity for everyone listening, it's tech and style, as in, you know, for the textile lab. But not T-E-X-T-I-L-E, but T-E-C-H and style. One of the things I was trying to do as the director of the fashion school at the time was really just show that we have a lot of resources here that probably a lot of people didn't know about. They might have heard of the museum and, you know, but that there was something going on. And, you know, by bringing students from different parts of the country and even Canada, many, many times we've had students participating from Canada that, you know, and that bring that back, it creates an energy that helps to amplify it in future years. And so it also just helped our students, not just the fashion students, realize that what they're doing is essentially, you know, on par or competitive with their peers at other institutions. And I think that was important.
Well, I happened to be there for the kickoff of the first hackathon. And as you talked about energy, oh my goodness, it was just electrifying. And I so wanted, I had driven a group of our graduate students across the country, across Ohio, which, you know, it was quite the drive in the snow. And I really wanted to stay up and just watch the hackathon, but I had to drive everyone back. And so I wasn't able to, but we were there for the opening ceremony and the kickoff of the event and for the very first one. And it was just electrifying. It was really cool. So now, because I've also been in your building where the Design Innovation Initiative is, and you have so many great spaces. Yeah. So what type of...
The Fashion Tech Hackathon and then maybe Sky Hack and some of the others that we were kind of pioneering before we were able to renovate this, what was the old art building, on the Kent campus and turn it into the Design Innovation Hub. That all of those experiences were kind of informing how we were thinking about the use of space and access and how people work together and what could we do. And so I had the deep fortune, I would say, of being able to be involved very directly for the full 2 years of the design build process for this building, along with my colleagues, where we were informing the architects, the designing architects and the architects of record locally and the construction management firms on on the philosophy of what we were trying to achieve, which is a building that is about hosting these kind of collaborative challenge-based innovation events. So instead of thinking of it as this room does X and this room does Y and, you know, it has fixed furniture, et cetera, the building is designed in a way where almost all of the furniture is on wheels and can be reconfigured, and students can build teams and move into different places. And, you know, and so, and you know, the concept of the building was that we knew we needed to have food in the building. So we really lobbied to get a dining facility, which is now the second largest dining facility on campus, in our building. And so have that ability to kind of host and support and create energy and fluidity. And then also just make it feel like there's a lot of different tools and technologies in this building, but to feel like all of those things are accessible to anyone, and you know, that you know, the barrier to entry and use is as low as possible.
That's great.
That is really great. Yeah. So when did the renovation of the hub happen, and when did you start using the facility?
Yeah. So we had the sort of groundbreaking of the construction project at the end of 2018, mm-hmm. and it opened formally in the fall of 2020. So the sad part was we opened the building when no one could come to campus. The interesting thing, though, was this was a little bit of a design innovation story in a way, is that it made us really think differently about, well, what is a building opening for? What is it about? What do we want to, you know, like, because, you know, there's a tradition of groundbreakings and, you know, ribbon cuttings when the building is open. And, you know, I would have guessed, even in the best of circumstances, we might have had 200 to 300 maybe people who would show up on the given day and, you know, be part of that party, basically. What we did instead was we had an alumnus, recent alum, was a military veteran who had launched a new business using the Matterport technology platform for scanning building interiors. That was focused on scanning apartments and various other things for real estate use. And he was actually engaged in a bunch of other creative applications. But we contracted with him to do really high resolution digital walkthrough scans, 3D scans of the whole building. And then his platform, that part of what he was developing, this was a platform that really allowed for adding a lot more rich content to that experience. So essentially, we created a virtual walkthrough of the DI Hub and launched it on, you know, on that day in November in 2020. And even in that first day, so we did a lot of things to that experience. So the digital walkthrough had, we gamified it a little bit. We 3D printed design innovation coins and spread them throughout the building during the scan process, so that anybody who was going to walking through the digital version of the building, if they found a coin, they could show that they'd found that coin. And if they found at least 20 of the digital DI coins, then they would get a limited edition t-shirt of the grand opening that we would ship anywhere in the world. And so we had, you know, and then every room, we had the students who we hired some student employees to help us set up the labs and facilities. And they all, in a really grassroots way, helped to create video clips and information about the, you know, about the tools and technologies and the spaces. And all of that content was in that experience. And so in reality, people were able to, on the very first day, before the end of that day, we already had, I think it was 16 people who had virtually walked through the building. And they had all spent at least 15 minutes in the virtual platform, you know, which, you know, if you know web graphic kind of experiences, having people stay in an environment or on a page for 15 minutes is pretty impressive. Right. So we were, you know, that was kind of a nice result. And then, you know, it's stayed available in a way that we've had, you know, now it's, I think, over 7,000 people who've spent time walking through the digital version of the hub. And, you know, that means that we, on that very first day, had guests from all over the world who were curious about what we were doing. So, yeah, it was, you know, so it would have been nice to have a party in the building, but it was a really nice experience to see what was happening. And I think it was well orchestrated.
Well, and it's such a great example of, you know, one of the aspects of innovation is problem solving, and you innovatively decide, you know, found a way to deal with that, which it sounds like the hub, the link is still alive, and people still
Yep. Yeah. Still can be viewed. So we're actually in the process now of trying to decide if we're going to go through an update. So, you know, a lot has happened in the last 4 years. We finally had some, you know, probably by 2022, I could say we were solidly back in the building and hosting courses and workshops and everything else. So it's still kind of building itself up. But, you know, what we have in the building is a series of open access maker environments, and we treat it like a membership, sort of like the rec center on campus. For all students and employees, the access is free, but you have to have a membership and come through an orientation to, you know, to get started. And we also have a community membership, so anybody in our community can pay a monthly fee to have the same access as everyone else. We, you know, so essentially since 2022, we've built up I think actually, I don't know if we reached the marker yet or not, but we were just under 2,000 our community or collaborators that are actively using the building. So it's making its way up in terms of, you know, folks who see the value and are trying to come in and utilize it that way. Those spaces and the use of those tools also give us a platform for really talking or, you know, connecting with people and talking about why human-centered design, why team-based collaboration, and kind of get them involved in other events that are more than just if they came in to use the 3D printer, they're going to hear a little bit more than just, you know, use that tool.
That's great. That I love that you have made it accessible to the community, the surrounding community. And, you know, higher ed, oftentimes we have that mission of serving the communities that we're located in. That's really,
yeah, I think it's not, it's hopefully it's serving the community, but it's self-serving as well, right? Like the cool thing is if you get community members who are motivated and interested. I mean, we have a woman who has been using the facility. She's in her mid-70s. She came in like 3D printing away and talking to all the students, and you know, like that intergenerational interaction and also the knowledge sharing that happens because of that. It's another way of embracing that difference, right? Like thinking about how we learn to see together.
Love it. I love it. I love it. Yes. Intergenerational. I mean, that is fabulous because, you know, one thing that, you know, for our audience that oftentimes happens in communities where there's a college or a university that you oftentimes have a lot of people that retire in those. And the nice thing and part of the reason why they retire is so that they can, you know, continue to learn, have access to lectures and resources. And so for someone to have, you know, maybe be a retiree and have access to, you know, this amazing innovation center. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, we just did a profile article, like a little feature article on one of our community collaborators who's a retired faculty member from math department. And he developed a whole model for a Latin cube, which I won't go into what that is, but basically a mathematical structure that's very complex and a really, you know, really cool manifestation of the concept by, you know, working with our students on a 3D printed, you know, conceptual model. So, there's really, that's what we hope to actually help grow, continue to grow as well. As like, not only are those individuals who can come in and do more for themselves, but they can also help to contribute and might be our future, you know, workshop leaders. Absolutely. And those sort of things as well.
Okay, you mentioned workshops. So what types of workshops do you offer?
We've kind of put our workshop thinking and our, you know, sort of our offerings that are, because hackathons kind of fit in this category too, but in terms of the workshops, it's the three kind of streams. One is the maker stream. So there are some obvious ones like intro to 3D printing, laser cutting. We have a water jet cutter, extended reality tools and technology. So, you know, like a lot of universities like Iowa State has, you know, there's a range of tools. And so there's some, you know, maker driven learning in that one. The second stream is really more of our innovation stream. So it really, at Kent State with the Design Innovation Initiative, we developed our own DI toolkit, which is I usually describe it as a mashup of a combination of design, design thinking, human-centered design, and innovation strategies that we call the recipe for design innovation at Kent State. And I could talk more about that too, but that stream basically starts with things like, you know, workshop activities about around finding your superpower and really understanding the role of empathy and in innovation and design. You know, continues into a range of things that have to do with ideation and gaining deeper insight, and then continues into practices of prototyping, testing, evaluating, implementing. And so that's that stream. And then the third stream is really kind of a partnership connection with LaunchNet in entrepreneurial. We call it the venture stream, but so not specifically always about business, but about certainly about, you know, launching a direction and an action. And so that one is more focused on the mindset that is addressing, you know, marketability in the various ways that might occur.
So someone that maybe is developing intellectual property, they might be in the venture, or they might go to.
Yep. Yeah. So, you know, gaining more insight into what it would look like if you did want to start a business and, you know, partnering in this. So there's a number of mentoring sessions and then workshops around that, the legal issues and copyright and IP protection, all of that.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, we have another guest that's coming on that's written a book on innovation management. That's expertise in that area too. So this will be a nice linkage there. Okay. So you mentioned the toolkit and the how you define design innovation at Kent State. Tell us how it's defined.
Yep. Yeah, so designing the design innovation model or approach that we're using, because first I want to say that, and I still have conversations on a pretty regular basis, there are people who are afraid of or uncomfortable with the fact that we've used the word design, and then there are people who are really uncomfortable with the fact that we've used the word innovation. But we did have a large group of leaders from and students and folks from all across the university, we had a lot of discussions about what should we call this initiative. And ultimately, the prevailing kind of sentiment was design innovation. And this term has been established and used in other contexts nationally and internationally. But I think we realized that we were trying to do something a little bit different. And so that is what inspired the DI toolkit. I know and Pierce and colleagues knew that we it wouldn't make sense for us to develop something that's completely new and different without building on what already exists. And so the toolkit really is a way of framing, or like I was saying, it's kind of the recipe that still makes use of or really references a lot of different tools that have been developed by others. The difference is that, and I guess I would call this a slight or an intentional evolution past some of the core approaches to design thinking and human-centered design, which one of my criticisms of it historically has been, especially design thinking, is that even though empathy has been a focus of the start of that, you know, of design thinking for a long time, there was an assumption early on that people knew we could immediately just launch into, practicing empathy in the context of trying to see and solve problems with others. And usually it was actually for others first, but then it became with others, right? So so that really led us down a path of realization that and it's a little bit about what I was talking earlier, that we don't, another thing we don't do in the US is teach each other how to work in teams. And that the truth is, the recipe that we're using at Kent State for design innovation is 100% centered around collaborative innovation. So yes, each of us as individuals has to build the competencies and capabilities, but it's about collaboration. And if you really want to know what in a collaborative context leads to innovation, you have to address how the team works, not just what the team's going to do, right? So what we do is spend at the beginning stage, we spend a lot more time. It starts with finding your superpowers, understanding what it is that you bring when you're working with others and recognizing those things in others as a way to build a novel way to work together. And the point of that, and it is a diversity exercise. The point of that really is to make sure that as in any given team, we find a way to make sure that everyone's voice is heard and that and that everyone is expected to contribute because we all bring our own perspective, that if we can build the trust and communicate together, we can then begin to see it in a truly transdisciplinary way, not just a, you know, a transactional way. A lot of team-based work, certainly for our students who, you know, like if you've been on a team as a student in the past, probably you've had the range of really bad experiences because not a lot of instruction as to how to work with your team and how to select your team. And so most of the time what happens in team-based work is kind of a baton toss, like I'll do this part, you do that part approach, right? That's not design innovation. What we're talking about is transdisciplinary, meaning we're putting it together and helping us all to see differently because of that connection. And so that's the early part of the toolkit and really leads into that along with storytelling. Like how do we help to build? And the elements in our toolkit, there are 11 elements in the toolkit. They're all relevant at every stage of the process. So they hint a little bit at a sequence, but it's really about a meta awareness that you have to bring and practice. And the end result of, from my point of view, the end result of the DI toolkit is that we're really helping ourselves and others to practice becoming fearless collaborators. And so we've focused in on the profile of what is a fearless collaborator? Like, what does that look like? You know, if we're thinking about that graduate we were talking about earlier, a fearless collaborator is someone who can, you know, who is willing, first of all, to meet new people, jump into a new team, who knows how to connect, to communicate, to start to build trust, and visualize, even when people are speaking different languages and, you know, whatever might be presented in that scenario. And then they have the ability and they have a knowledge of the tools and activities that will help them to address whatever problem they're trying to tackle together in ways that really facilitate towards an innovation outcome. And so that fearless collaborator profile, one of the things I always say about design innovation and human-centered design is that it's not a discipline. I don't personally believe it should be a degree program, although there's a lot to learn. But it's a process. It's a process that we have to practice and repeat and practice and repeat and to become a fearless collaborator, inhabit that. It's also maintenance. You have to continue that practice, just like a, you know, like designer as well. And so the toolkit I think of as the backbone for how we decide what strategies we do in DI, and then it becomes that reference point.
Oh, I love it. I mean, you all have really thought this out so well, and I love the term fearless collaborator because it just kind of just puts a label on us, like, you know, because there is fear in collaboration. There always is, you know, and people are like, well, you know, like I said, you know, you're trying to get to know someone, you're trying to trust. And so as you are, you know, working with students and your community there at Kent State to like, okay, we're going to be fearless collaborators. I love it.
Yeah, and that, for me, the other thing that coming from the design background and from the making background with textiles and other tools, I think what I also really want to embed in this is that making is entangled. It has to be part of a design innovation approach. And that if you think about it from what we just talked about, like making becomes a way of actually starting communication when people don't know how to talk to each other. You can play with Lego or you can, you know, Play-Doh, whatever it is. You by making, you start a conversation and you really literally create ways of seeing that are much harder to do in vocalization, right? And so then making becomes a way of ideating and exploring and playing that helps people to back away from their from their conceptual blocks that they might have about whatever the problem is. And as a result, allows to the reframing to start to occur. And then, you know, then making becomes a way of prototyping, you know, solutions and testing and getting feedback. And then ultimately is the, you know, the path that leads to implementation. So building the culture, the maker culture into that is really critical, I think, to how we facilitate that work inside the team. And that work for whatever is, you know, for whatever the constituency is that we're working with to try to solve a problem.
Well, I love that you say that too, because the making, the tangible, and having taught the majority of the curriculum I've taught over the years has been making curriculum. I've taught a lot of other things, but a lot of it has been making. And There is a different risk with making. And if you combine that with being a team member and making, you know, which is reality. I mean, most, when you go out there into industry, you're going to be making or serving or creating or, you know, something and with a team.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what's embedded in that, both in the innovation culture, which is not really there in other parts of the university. Like, you know, if you have an innovation culture, you're trying to embrace a fail and fail fast kind of approach, that it's okay to jump in to a team and do goofy stuff, right? And make mistakes, because that's actually what, you know, allows us to know where we're really headed, and to reflect and learn really quickly. And that for me also led to, the realization that a student, and actually faculty for this matter, almost all of the other spaces on campus at the university have consequence for failure. If you're in the classroom or the studio or the laboratory, I mean, like, you know, or you're in a class, right? Every one of those environments has it's a performance based environment that has pretty big consequences in some case for failure, right? So it breeds a fear of failure that is not in line with the culture of innovation. And so what we try to do in this building is totally embrace the failure aspect and say, go for it. We might break the machine, but let's see what happens. And do that in a informed risk way, but in a way that changes the narrative. Because if you want to make the space have the lowest barrier to entry and be accessible to the widest audience, you have to create the culture for people to be willing to step over the threshold. And that's kind of what the Fearless Collaborator is about too.
I love it. I love it. Being able to fail, being able to, you know, screw something up, break something, you know, it's not the end of the world. I wanted to just touch back on, you know, the team work and empathy, because like you said, people, I don't think they even know sometimes how to define empathy. You know, it's a word out there. And then working in teams is something I used to do, especially at Colorado State, because I taught a lot of team-based courses. I integrated it into the curriculum. But we always spent time on, you know, each person's abilities, their strengths, their fears. I had the students do a little survey, and then they had to talk with each other about it so they could get to know each other and, you know, understand their roles in the team and, you know, how that team worked. And that's something I feel that in industry we don't do sometimes, in higher ed we don't, you know, with people within any team, you know, an academic department, a business team. I mean, what are some of your, you know, you've mentioned some of your thoughts, but do you have like some advice for, like, okay, if you're a leader of a team, you know, how do you get that team to take the time to get to know each other before they try to jump in and solve a problem?
Yeah, no, I think there are probably two parts to that that I hear, which is, I guess my first response is that, you know, you're absolutely right, especially in the workplace. It's pretty rare that we take time to build that, you know, that the trust and connection that's needed. And then, you know, that ability to actually work and see together. And yet it's pretty well shown in research that the time spent on doing that work is well worth it. It's what sets the ability to, you know, to accelerate the innovation process, right? The challenge there is that you have to start thinking about, as a leader, how do you do that in incremental but important ways, and how do we need to take this time, even when we feel the pressure of delivery, that, you know, of whatever outcome we're supposed to be doing, we need to take that time. So part of the way that, you know, one of the, and this was, you know, recommendations from multiple directions, but some of it was connected to SciPartners, which are is the company that developed the Superpowers app that we use a lot of the time. Structuring your day differently and how we connect as a team. Like one of the things that we do, which is more like a, you know, coaching or huddle, beginning of each, for the first 3 years of our existence as a team in design innovation, the beginning of every day we got together as a team and started with, you know, each individual, what are you working on? What's coming up next? What do you need help with? And just taking the time to make that important and do it repetitively on a daily basis, as opposed to wait until we've got like the equivalent of a faculty meeting where everybody's like emotionally charged for something that they haven't been able to talk out for a while. You know that. So it's about taking the time for those things. And it's still always hard, but I think that's important. I think that's probably the main thing is really just, you know, like figuring out how to then start implementing or working on and being okay with the fact that some of that involves, you know, like we actually do as a team now, our team of six staff members that we have for this huge building, we deliver a lot on a pretty regular basis. But it's because we've spent a lot of time building our capacity to do that. We know what each other is capable of and is going to do. In some of those situations and we build on our strengths together. And so that's sadly, it's still not that common in a lot of workplace experiences.
It isn't. In one of my leadership positions, I tried a kind of like a book club with us, you know, so that we could get to know each other around the topic. Oh, they hated it. I mean, you know, I think we lasted a semester doing it. And then the next semester there was like, we don't want to do this. We don't want to do that. Okay. I'm ready. And there were some people that wanted to, but there were some very loud voices that were like, you know, and they just didn't see the benefit of, you know, talking about larger issues outside of the department that can help us get to know each other too.
It's really true. There's often a lot of resistance, and sadly, in some of those scenarios, if you have one individual who's not on board, it can be a lot more work, right? So, going back to the empathy aspect, one of the tools that I use all the time, and that we share a lot is Marie Miyashiro published a book called The Empathy Factor, and a tool that was embedded in that called the gradients of agreement. And it just allows us all to see that we're never black and white with our decisions and recommendations. And we just need to understand where everybody's at. And by doing that and making it more understood that we can actually have the conversations that help us pull it to make a decision together. So the other thing that came to mind as you were saying that is that one of the themes tied to making that really I've been thinking about exploring further is, you know, the concept of making time, it has the same kind of intentionality and purpose and we have to figure out in our lives, we really do have to figure out how to make the time, to see what, you know, to see the goals that we want. But, and that's, you know, I think that's connected to the Stanford D School's like design your life philosophy, right? But it's also about, that, you know, even though it seems like it's finite and we have no control over it, we can craft and make what we need to achieve what we're trying to get to. And then sometimes that's work. Something like a book club, it might not seem like work initially, right? It's about the work and it leads to the work. And so, yeah.
Oh my goodness. I'm going to have you back like multiple times. You know, I can always just, you know, talk with you and listen to you talk about, you know, my favorite topics, you know, design and innovation for like hours on it. And also, you know, we didn't even get through like, you know, I don't know, any of the questions that I originally had for you. But I do want to know, your thoughts on defining innovation, because we have everyone that comes on. How do you define innovation?
I would say this is not a textbook way of thinking about it, but this is certainly how I would describe innovation in the mindset that we're trying to work on with our initiative here. I think of innovation as an intentional and thoughtful process of making positive change together. We do that by embracing the diversity to see and to solve, potentially to, and then to implement solutions together. And so that to me is really, it's a softer definition of innovation, but it's really what it's about. If we think about the difference between, or, you know, where, you know, what we're heading into in the future of work, and with the growth and machine learning and artificial intelligence and just everything else, I think we need a really human definition of what innovation is. And this feels like it's getting closer to it for me.
Well, I like that you used the word together in it a couple of times as you were talking, and that really really wraps up nicely, you know, everything that we talked about, you know, collaboration and together and the humanness. And so I think oftentimes when people hear the word innovation, they think tech only, technology, hard innovation, fail fast, you know, rapid prototyping, all of that. But there is.
Yeah. I mean, I believe it's a cultural activity that really means it's about making change and it's about making it happen. You know, like that. And so in the tech sense, it's not just having an idea. Obviously, it's bringing it to market. But that's the same thing. It's about making positive change together that, that we implement together.
Oh, well, that's a great way for us to end our session. And again, I will be bugging you again to come back at some point, because I know you're always doing so many interesting things. So thank you for being here this evening.
Yeah, no, thank you. This is great.
Well, for our guests, if you want to learn more about J.R. Campbell and his work and the Design Innovation Initiative, make sure that you check out the Kent State website. We'll also make sure that there's a link to it in the description of the podcast. For our listeners, just thank you for tuning in to this episode. It was just a joy to have this discussion with JR. Please subscribe, leave a review, leave a comment, share this with your network, and continue to explore and celebrate innovation and how we together can transform through innovation. So, as I always say at the end, keep innovating, keep dreaming, and keep making a difference.